headlines. Iran says it wants to maintain friendly ties with its neighbors, but will not tolerate geopolitical change of the Caucasus.
We have serious concerns about the presence of terrorists and Zionists in the region.
The Russian president says that Europe is to blame for its ongoing energy crisis, saying that Moscow stands ready to stabilize the market. Also in the headlines, a UK court says Dubai's ruler ordered the hacking of his ex-wife's phone as part of a sustained campaign of intimidation during the children custody case. Thanks for joining us. Iran's foreign minister has voiced concern about the presence of Israel in the South Caucasus, near Iran's border with Azerbaijan.
We certainly never accept any geopolitical change and map change in the Caucasus. We have serious concerns about the presence of terrorists and Zionists in the region.
Hossein Amir Abdollahian was speaking after a meeting with his Russian counterpart, Sergei Lavrov, in Moscow. The top Iranian diplomat also warned against Israel's provocative activities in the region. He said that Iran wants to maintain friendly ties with its neighbors. Further in his remarks, Amir Abdollahian touched upon a terrorist attack against an Iranian nuclear site in the city of Karaj, which Tehran has blamed on Israel.
We are concerned that the IAEA did not react to a terrorist incident at the Karaj nuclear site. We would not be pleased if the agency pursues politically motivated goals of some countries.
Amir Abdollahian also spoke about resuming talks aimed at reviving the 2015 nuclear deal. He said that he expects the negotiations to start soon in the Austrian capital. The Russian foreign minister, for his part, said the international community is waiting for the U.S. to return to its obligations under the agreement. Lavrov said that Washington should end illegal restrictions on Iran and all of its trading partners. The U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the multilateral accord in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. Talks on reviving the deal remain stalled over what Iran calls excessive demands by the U.S. and its allies.
Iran has said the United States must effectively remove all 800 illegal sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled under former President Donald Trump. Tehran says such a measure serves as a ticket for Washington to return to the negotiating table. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Saeed Khatibzadeh, said the Islamic Republic would definitely resume negotiations with the P4 plus one group of countries, including Britain, France, Russia, and China plus Germany in the Austrian capital, Vienna. However, he added, Tehran is still reviewing the details of the six rounds of Vienna talks held under the previous Iranian administration. Khatibzadeh said, Iran's new administration is currently trying to, quote, find out why the previous talks did not reach a satisfactory phase or a document that all sides will be happy with. He said Tehran is trying to find out the issues that need to be addressed properly in the upcoming talks. The Iranian official said the U.S. is required to remove all the sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled by Trump and ensure that Washington will no longer violate the JCPOA. Khatibzadeh also added the new U.S. administration has not changed its policy towards Iran. The sanctions imposed by the Trump administration are in place right now, and we have not seen any meaningful or great change in their policy towards Iran.
As Richard Haass, the head of CFR, has just recently published in Foreign Affairs, there is no difference in practice in foreign policy of President Biden or President Trump. All of them are doing the same thing, and when it is more serious, it's beyond the wordplay that each plays. So the point is that the Americans need to realize that they need to be more practical and they need to be more serious about the negotiations.
Hatibzadeh made the remarks amid a pause in Vienna talks between Iranian and P4 plus one delegations on a potential revival of the JCPOA.
Iran has said that the U.S. needs to remove all 800 sanctions imposed after President Trump unilaterally withdrew from the 2015 nuclear deal. Iran has also said that the U.S. is required to remove all the sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled by Trump, and to ensure that Washington will no longer violate the JCPOA.
Back in September, Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian slammed the U.S.'s lack of commitment and Europe's inaction regarding the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, saying the Islamic Republic is ready for result-oriented talks on the agreement's revival that would secure people's rights and interests. Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled out of the JCPOA in May 2018 and reimposed the anti-Iran sanctions that the deal had lifted. He also placed additional sanctions on Iran under other pretexts not related to the nuclear case as part of the so-called maximum pressure campaign. Following a year of strategic patience, Iran resorted to its legal rights stipulated in Article 26 of the JCPOA, which grants a party the right to suspend its contractual commitments in case of non-compliance by other signatories and let go of some of the restrictions imposed on its nuclear energy program. Meanwhile, the new U.S. administration under President Biden says it wants to compensate for Trump's mistake and rejoin the deal, but it is showing an overriding tendency for maintaining some of the sanctions as a tool of pressure.
So if they want Iran to be back to the table, if they want Iran to to be ready to accept the limitations of the JCPOA, they should actually, the Americans and the Europeans, need to realize that they need to meet their own obligations as well. So Iran is actually entitled to benefit economically from the JCPOA, and
Tehran insists that all sanctions should first be removed in a verifiable manner before the Islamic Republic reverses its counteractive measures. Meanwhile, a high-level Israeli delegation has visited the U.S. over the Iran nuclear deal. The Israeli team has requested that the United States formulate a backup plan in case Iran does not return to talks.
Regarding other scenarios, there are not much options on the table. The Israeli officials are talking about imposing further sanctions, painful sanctions, such things, which we all know that it's nothing but just some bluffing.
Israel has reportedly called on Americans to levy significant and painful sanctions on Iran if it does not sign the deal. Top U.S. officials have also told Israelis that Washington would pursue other venues if diplomacy fails.
The Russian president says Europe is to blame for its ongoing energy crisis, rejecting accusations that Moscow is withholding gas supplies to pressure the West.
We can see where unbalanced decisions, unbalanced actions, and abrupt movements can bring us. Today, as I said before, we can clearly see it on European energy markets.
Putin said the mistake includes the termination of long-term contracts in favor of the spot market. He also cited Europe's transition to green energy and no investments in the extraction industries. The Russian president noted that his country is boosting gas supplies to Europe and stands ready to stabilize the market. Gas prices on the continent have surged by more than 25% amid growing demand before the winter. Critics have accused Moscow of intentionally limiting gas supplies to Europe in an effort to hasten the launch of Nord Stream 2, a pipeline connecting Russia with Germany. A British court has ruled that Dubai's ruler, Sheikh Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum, has run a sustained campaign of intimidation and threats against his ex-wife. Court said the ruler had ordered the hacking of phones of Princess Haya bint Al Hussein and her lawyers using the Israeli software Pegasus. The ruling said those working for Sheikh Mohammed also tried to buy a mansion next to Haya's estate near London. The court said these represent an abuse of trust and power. The Sheikh has denied the hacking allegations. Sheikh Mohammed and Haya have been involved in a bitter custody battle since she fled to Britain with their two children. The latest ruling comes 19 months after the court concluded that the Dubai ruler had abducted two of his daughters. Germany's Greens and Free Democratic Party said that they want to start three-way coalition talks with the Social Democrats after it gained a narrow victory over ruling conservatives in last month's general elections.
It is not a complete rejection of a union with the conservatives. They have really made an effort. Nevertheless, there are big differences between us, and that is why we propose to the liberals to get closer to the Social Democrats and to have dialogue with them.
In a press conference, Greens co-leader Annalena Baerbock also said that Germany is facing great challenges and needs a new beginning. The move puts the Social Democrats' Olaf Scholz a step closer to succeeding outgoing Chancellor Angela Merkel after his party secured nearly 26% of the votes. Meanwhile, the leader of the conservative Christian Democrats, Armin Laschet, said that his party respects the decision but insisted that he is still ready to hold talks with the Greens and FDP. Laschet's remarks come as CDU-CSU has witnessed its worst ever election results after it garnered a little over 24% of the votes in the elections. Pope Francis has expressed shame at the sexual abuse of children by French Catholic priests revealed in a report this week.
I would like to express to the victims my sadness, my pain for the trauma they have suffered, and also my shame, our shame. For too long, there has been an inability of the church to put them at the center of its concerns.
The pontiff called on the clergy to work in order to avoid the repetition of such situations. He urged Catholics in France to take responsibility for the incidents to make the church a safe home for everyone. His remarks come one day after an independent investigation laid bare that French Catholic priests sexually abused more than 200,000 children over the past seven decades. The independent commission was set up in 2018 in response to a series of scandals that shook the Catholic Church in France and worldwide. An estimated 200,000 people have demonstrated against economic austerity in France after unions called the first nationwide strike since the outbreak of the coronavirus. Major cuts to unemployment insurance are set to go into effect despite widespread economic uncertainty and continually increasing inequality. Ramin Mazari reports from Paris.
From the yellow vests to the longest general strike the country has ever seen, France under President Emmanuel Macron has been the site of constant grassroots expression, but also shocking political repression. For the first time since the coronavirus epidemic began, France's unions called a nationwide strike, with protests taking place in over 200 cities and towns. Unions and workers are accusing politicians and bosses of manipulating the corona crisis in order to ram through more far-right economic austerity measures. Deeply unpopular cuts to unemployment insurance take effect this week, despite the ongoing economic uncertainty.
The government has used a pretext of health concerns, cut wages, to cut government jobs, to reduce worker rights, and to allow bad working conditions to get even worse. It's great to see everyone from workers to students to pensioners back in the streets again, because these cuts to unemployment are unacceptable during these tough times.
A decade of failed austerity, followed by the unprecedented corona recession, has given France's lower and middle classes a list of problems too long to fully mention. Inflation, energy prices, intense corona-related restrictions on personal freedom, unemployment, soaring inequality. But perhaps most telling is that even conservative politicians now talk of the need to, quote, make work pay, because French wages and salaries have been so stagnant for so long.
La vie a augmenté à tous les niveaux.
The cost of living does nothing but increase, and in seemingly every possible way. Costs are even higher than when the yellow vests first began, but we haven't been allowed to demonstrate. Until salaries are increased, things will continue to be more and more difficult for the French.
protesters say that the coronavirus lockdowns and work cutbacks are too often presented as some sort of welcome and generously subsidized vacation. The reality is they have been catastrophic for many average households. The French street is alive with protest for the first time in over 1.5 years, and it may decide the outcome of Macron's re-election bid this April. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Democrat lawmakers in the U.S. Congress have warned against a looming downgrade in credit rating amid a continued deadlock over the country's debt limit. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer called the potential downgrade disastrous. He said too many Republicans were pushing Washington to the edge of default. The Treasury Secretary earlier said the crisis could trigger another recession. President Joe Biden also announced that Democrats are considering making an exception to a Senate rule to extend the government's borrowing limit without help from the Republicans. The stalemate came as the Republicans vowed to block a vote to raise the government's borrowing cap. If the deadlock holds, the U.S. will not have funds to meet its obligations to creditors and could default on its $28 trillion in debt by mid-October. New York Times reveals that the U.S. spy agency has admitted to losing a troubling number of informants in different countries. The Daily cites people familiar with the matter as saying that a top-secret cable sent by counterintelligence officials to the CIA revealed that many informants were either captured or killed, or turned into double agents. The memo was directed to frontline CIA staff, urging them to manage agents better. It said dozens of lost informants were recruited in countries like China, Russia, Iran, and Pakistan. The cable also raised the issues plaguing the agency, like being too trusting of sources, underestimating foreign spy agencies, and recruiting informants without proper vetting. A CIA spokesperson declined a New York Times request to comment on the revelations. That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
UK businesses blame the pandemic and Brexit for a shortage of overseas workers, with 38% saying a lack of regional talent was hurting their ability to recruit much-needed staff. We now present you an article written by Kalyina Markotov. The piece is titled, Survey Finds Staff Shortages Spreading to All Corners of UK Business. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Survey has warned staff shortages are rippling out from the haulage, farming and hospitality sectors to almost all parts of the British economy, putting severe pressure on medium-sized businesses across the United Kingdom. More than a quarter of the 500 firms polled said the lack of staff was putting pressure on their ability to operate at normal levels, with reduced stock due to the resulting supply chain disruption hurting their business. While some firms had considered cutting production, others were planning to raise prices, leading to concerns over rising inflation as the Christmas trading period approaches. Nearly a fifth said they were increasing wages to attract new staff, while others were introducing extra perks to lure workers. But the report released by accountancy and advisory firm BDO said the knock-on effect for consumers could be significant, with nearly one-third of businesses saying the prices would need to rise in the next 3 to 6 months to keep up with the disruption. More than one-third of firms in the survey said they had also cut down on the kinds of products and services on offer, with a further third planned to do the same over the coming months unless the situation radically improves. A similar proportion expects stock ranges to be affected long term. Businesses blamed the pandemic and Brexit for the shortage of overseas workers, with 38% saying a lack of regional talent was hurting their ability to recruit much-needed staff. BDO partner Ed Duan said, "Brexit, global supply chain issues and the long tail of COVID-19 has created a perfect storm for British businesses." Ed Duan added, "After navigating the challenges of the pandemic and hoping for some respite, businesses have found themselves facing more major disruption, with those across almost all sectors reporting staff shortages. This is an era of upheaval, and the challenges faced by the UK's mid-tier, the engine of the UK's economy, points to a long road ahead." The survey lays bare the challenges facing all tiers of British business. Heavy goods vehicle driver shortages have already resulted in fuel shortages across the country, while large companies such as Tesco warned recently that the labour crunch could lead to empty supermarket shelves and panic buying in the lead-up to Christmas, unless the government relaxed immigration rules. Prime Minister Boris Johnson's government has since introduced emergency visas that will allow a potential 300 fuel drivers to arrive immediately and stay until the end of March, and let a potential 4,700 further food haulage drivers arrive from late October and leave by the end of February. Elsewhere, according to the latest business confidence survey from consultancy firm CGA, and technology services firm Forth, the hospitality sector is also suffering from a lack of workers, with one in six jobs currently vacant. Only 18% of the 200 businesses in the restaurant and coffee shop industries said they were confident that they would be able to recruit and retain the staff needed to run their businesses. That is a dramatic drop from the 67% who felt secure about their talent prospect just 3 months ago. Around two-thirds said they expect to be hiring staff at a higher rate than usual this year, and were already struggling with absences, reporting that on average about 6% of staff were currently in isolation due to ongoing COVID risks. The shortage is forcing businesses to step up efforts to attract and keep hold of staff, with three-quarters saying they have offered better pay, while two-thirds have tried to cultivate the right working culture to retain workers. Bosses who have increased pay say they had hiked wages by up to 11% on average for current staff and 13% for new hiring. The report said that higher wages, while pile extra costs on the hospitality sector, which was already facing rising food, drink, supply and utility costs. One of CGA's directors, Carl Chessel, said the figures illustrated the full scale of the hospitality sector's recruitment and retention crisis, and called for government support. Carl Chessel said thousands of businesses are now critically short of staff, while many of those who have sufficient labour face a fight to keep hold of it. He added, gaps at front and back of house and fast-rising wage costs threaten to derail the industry's recovery, and sustained targeted government support is now urgently needed to tackle the problem.
Discovering Islam.
After birth, death is the greatest event in every person's life. It is the most private experience of every individual that cannot be shared with anyone else. Their death is followed by the destruction of the body as we know. However, would that mean the total destruction of the person? Why do we die at all? What is the philosophy of our temporary life on this earth? Why is death so scary for many people? Is the dichotomy of soul and body true? And if that is the case, what is the soul and how would it leave the body? If there is one thing that we can be certain of, it's that we will die. Yet death remains one of the greatest mysteries that man has ever known.
There is a definition of death which doctors give us, which is when the brain waves or the electrical waves in the brain stop. That would be counted as death.
Scientifically, death is the cessation of all biological functions that maintain a person. Roughly 150,000 people die around the world each day, so it should be one of the most familiar subjects for all. Most people wish that they never have to think about it or face death, and they're even scared to think about it.
If you ask someone to enter a room and no one would be able to leave that room and come back and give you an experience of how it felt to go into that room, many people would hesitate to enter that room. In the same way, when it comes to death, many people who have died, and none of them have returned back to life to give us or share with us how they experienced that death, or where did they go? So it's a transition to, for us in this world, and for many, somewhere unknown.
The word death conjures up an idea of the end of things. When we use death in English, we say when something dies, it seems to us almost to mean that it is now useless. It can be discarded. It has no value. It has lost its vitality. But it's not a very good word, or it hasn't taken a very good meaning in that way, because in Islam, death is a transference, according to many hadiths, from one abode to another abode. It is like walking through a doorway. If you call a doorway death, fine. It certainly is not an end to life. It is a continuation to life.
You know, we can understand why people find it uncomfortable to talk about death. And one of the reasons is because of the intense love we have for the world. And death signifies a departure from these attractive, beautiful things of the world.
All cultures correspond death with frightening thoughts and images. The reason for that is because we look at it from the departure side, because we are scared to leave what we are very much familiar with to the unknown.
However, if we were to see it as an arrival, we find it to be more of a blessing than a loss.
It's a shedding of clothes. It's taking, I don't know, you can say a shower and cleaning the filth from your body. So in other words, it's an existential thing. It's not absence of something. Unlike what we are brought up being taught, or indirectly or indirectly, about how death is absence of life. No, life is, as we know it, is something that has different stages in Islam. So it's not that we have life and then death. Life continues. We just have to shift. We have to cross the bridge. Imam Hussein alayhi salam on Ashura, he would tell his companions that be patient. Death is nothing but a bridge where you're crossing to go to the better stuff, to higher levels of existence and life, actually.
We are born for eternity, and death, unfortunately, is taken negatively as if it means the end. The Islamic explanation is that death is just a transfer. It's a gateway to enter the second, or the stage after this current stage. Stage one is this life. Stage two is transition between this life and the afterlife, the barzakh. Stage three, eternity.
What's important to realize is it's all like what we call the circle of life. There was the side of the human being descending from the higher up to dunya, and that's why dunya is called dunya, because it's at the bottom of the cycle, and then it will start to ascend back again to where it came from, and that's when the soul is separated from the body and the nafs goes back. Inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un.
Islam's picture of life and death is part of a broader process, part of a bigger process. It is simply a gateway into that which is to come.
Death is really the bridge that unites the lover with his beloved, meaning that, you know, man who loved his Lord, he now wants to meet his beloved, his creator.
Man is a traveling creature. He starts from a drop, to clinging mass, to a fleshy tissue, to a fetus, to a baby, to a child, to a youth, to an adult, to an elderly, and eventually to the grave. But is the journey going to stop here? Is this the end? Or there are other stations to this uninterrupted journey?
We have a verse in the Quran, Ya ayyuhal insan innaka kadihun ila rabbika kadhan famulaqih. O man, you're moving towards your Lord, you're traversing a path towards your Lord, and you will eventually meet him. This shows that we're on a journey, and life is a journey, and it ends with meeting our Lord. Does this journey end with death? The answer to this is that if we look at what the definition was in the beginning of life, then we'll understand that life doesn't end with death. And since life doesn't end with death and is continuous, then so the journey continues as well.
The baby's journey to the world is full of wonders, and the elderly travels to the grave is even more wondrous. Now, based on Islamic teachings, death is ripeness of the soul and its readiness to be picked and initiated into the wonders of a new life. It is the tunnel to a phenomenal world of wonders.
The death, as we know it, is not an end to life. Rather, it is a portal, a doorway into a new and more expansive existence. And indeed, as we move on in this journey from this dunya into barzakh and then later on to the day of judgment, we are constantly evolving and changing. We're not dying.
But where is the destination of this journey? How many more stations are out there? Where is the map for this long travel?
We're here for eternity. We're born for eternity, not for death. Yes, since death is going to take us closer to that eternity, then in a sense you can say we're born to die. But not we're born to die in the sense that we are born for absence of life. No, we are born so that eventually we will be transmitted from one level of existence in life to the next level of existence in life to eventually attain that eternity we were born for.
Some say there is no afterlife, but they only assume. And why should we follow their assumption? Why should we think that this journey should stop so abruptly? Why should man, this traveling creature, stop traveling? If he were to stop, why did he set out? Why shouldn't we follow those who claim knowledge of that side and listen to those who only assume?
Somebody recently sent me a picture of twins in the womb of mother. One of them arguing that there is no life after birth, another saying there is life after birth. So in the similar way, we are in this world. Those who believe, they are arguing there is no life after this world, and others say there is no, and there is life after this world.
I believe there is an afterlife, but I believe it cannot be objectively proven. It is something which you need to go inward through introspection, through interaction with Allah, seeing the signs in your life. I believe the afterlife can be discerned from this life itself.
We started from that drop of water, and we are where we are now. However, for the final destination, we need more progress. The Quran gives us some preview of what we may expect in our progress into future. We have to be prepared for that great encounter, meeting with the Lord, the Creator. He wants to share with us what he has. وَبَشِّرِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ بِأَنَّ لَهُمْ مِنَ اللَّهِ فَضْلًا كَبِيرًا. He loves that you live beside him, pure and honest. فِي مَقْعَدِ صِدْقٍ عِنْدَ مَلِيكٍ مُقْتَدِرٍ. He's waiting to meet you and to live with you forever. خَالِدِينَ فِيهَا نُزُلًا مِنْ عِنْدِ اللَّهِ.
Death is an astonishing path through the world of wonders. Some people have had flavors of that adventurous dimension on many instances of near-death experience.
Near-death experience is a personal, involuntary experience in which the person will see itself outside the body and while in a condition of a crisis like an accident or a surgery, and the person will be considered clinically dead, but then eventually the person will come back. And in the case of the near-death experience, the person will have a recollection of what happened during this period in which he or she was completely considered dead.
In his book, Life After Life, The Investigation of a Phenomenon, Survival of Body Death, the American psychologist and medical doctor Raymond Moody has compiled a huge data and presented extensive analysis on near-death experience. He's classified the experience of 150 patients with near-death experiences into several categories. Now, one group experienced that they left their bodies while they were absolutely conscious and could observe the efforts of the medical team. Another group felt that they were okay in a body different from their physical body. Now, Moody uses the term spiritual body for this.
In the case of the near-death experience, it happens when the person is close to death, or when this person is actually considered dead, which means no heartbeat, no brain activity whatsoever. So in this case, what happens is that the person will experience different things that we cannot see here, and the person will normally have some characteristics. For example, the person will hear sometimes noises that we call it intracranial sounds. It just happens inside of their heads. Then normally they see a tunnel. Many times they see a light at the end of the tunnel. So they float, or sometimes they just go quickly towards the light.
Other experiences implied losing the sense of physical time, peace and tranquility, confusion as a consequence of leaving the physical body. Another group reported that they saw a prominent religious personality in a body made of light.
Some others stated that initially they did not realize they were in a new body until they found out that the hearing and their vision of their relatives was too weak to see or hear them, although their own senses had intensified so that they could hear and see new things.
What these studies tell us is that firstly, our knowledge about human being is much less than what we assume. And secondly, we have to confess that our current scientific tools are inadequate for these novel areas of research. And finally, and most importantly, not everyone has the same experience of death.
يَعْلَمُونَ ظَاهِرًا مِنْ حَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا, the Quran says. People appreciate only very surface aspects of the creation. وَهُمْ بِالْآخِرَةِ هُمْ غَافِلُونَ. And they're oblivious of the expansive nature of what I have really created.
Generally, death is an experience similar to the birth of a baby, where it travels from one world to another. The difference, however, is that the baby cannot remember anything from its previous world, while the baby's soul is extremely astute and can feel the difference. By entering into that realm, the soul moves one step closer to its completion, and its power to comprehend the realities of existence would increase. Hence, it is now one stage nearer to the final destination, meeting with the Lord. A meeting which is not like meeting of a person with another person, but meeting of two worlds.
The whole purpose of this worldly life, this transient, ephemeral and fleeting 70 or 80 years, is that we prepare our souls, we make them ready and fit for the divine proximity and divine neighborhood, so that we become the neighbors of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We become fit to have that beatific vision in paradise.
The soul is very difficult to define, but in a simple expression, it is what we call I, the one who wills, who decides, who judges, who loves and hates, the one who uses the body as a means towards its end. We usually think that these are functions of the mind, While the mind is a simple conglomeration of absolutely separate cells,
we have to see what defines a person. Is it the body, or is it the me within the body? When we're growing up as kids, we have that me in us. As we grow older, we feel that this same me that I had when I was a kid is still that same me. Of course, experiences are added to me, but the me is the same me. We can't fool ourselves. As we grow older and older, the same me again and again. So, does the person die? We have to see. The body will die for sure. The body is destroyed for sure. But the person, no. The person will live on. That me, or in other words, the soul, is going to live on.
Meccans asked the Prophet, tell us what the ruh is. What is the spirit? He said, يَسْأَلُونَكَ عَنِ الْرُوحِ قُلِ الْرُوحُ مِنْ أَمْرِ رَبِّي. They ask you about the soul, what it is. Tell them that the soul is my Lord's command. And that's all you can understand. You can't understand more than that. And of course, you know, when I say you can't understand more than that, you know, some people will say, well, we live in a very enlightened age of science and technology and information, and we have everything on our fingertips. But let me tell you, you know, the best minds in physics, the best minds in biochemistry, the best minds in genetics, best minds in technology and engineering, and in every field will say to you, we only know this much. We only know this much of the physical world.
It is true that the soul knows this world by the help of body and its different organs. And if it was not for the body, the soul would have not known anything. It is as the Quran mentions, وَاللَّهُ أَخْرَجَكُمْ مِنْ بُطُونِ أُمَّهَاتِكُمْ لَا تَعْلَمُونَ شَيْئًا وَجَعَلَ لَكُمُ السَّمْعَ وَالْأَبْصَارَ وَالْأَفْئِدَةَ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَشْكُرُونَ. God has brought you forth from the wombs of your mothers while you did not know anything. He made for you hearing, eyesight, and hearts so that you may appreciate. Mutually, if it was not for the soul, the body would not have been able to do anything. Death happens when the soul leaves the body. The question is, what would the soul do without the body, which was its only means to every end? The answer is that it lives in another body.
When you die, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala puts your soul in another body. Now, let's say it like this. You have a body in the once you die as well. And you will eat, you will drink, and so on. Or you will be punished to an extent. So, and this is called the mithali body, they call it. Which means that you have that same shape and form, but you don't have material anymore. Okay, so you have height, width, maybe length, but you don't have that material. Okay, it's not something tangible. And that's why we, in this realm of life, we can't see those who have passed away.
The soul is the real us. The body is a vehicle. That's why when, for example, we look in the mirror and we say, I, we don't mean this body with its limbs. If we were to lose a hand tomorrow and look in the mirror, we'll still say I and mean the same thing. We won't say I less five fingers. So we have an understanding of the real us, who we refer to as I. This soul requires, depending on which environment it is in, a body of sorts. And there will be a more subtle body that it occupies as it moves on into Barzakh, and an even more subtle body that it occupies when it moves into the Day of Judgment.
Death is really a move from one realm of existence into another. It is moving from the physical world, the material world, the touchable world, the tangible world, into the realm of spirit, the realm that is spiritual, the realm that is beyond and above the laws of physics, really. Gravitation or material or physical things actually don't exist in that world. It's a world of its own, with its own laws and with its own way of operating.
That spiritualistic communication or spiritualistic sense is simply that sense which is not materialistic, the sense which is
got that third component, if we may call it.
Rumi refers to these senses in his famous book, Masnavi. There are five senses other than these five senses. Those are like red gold, while these are like copper. The prophets communicated with the angels through these senses, and the Prophet of Islam went to Mi'raj, the ascension, with his spiritual body, and heard and saw things by his spiritual senses. These senses would be activated for all after they die.
In this world, the soul is not able to manifest its true potentials. It is governed largely by the constraints of the material world around it. And it is an uneasy, if you like, passenger in the vehicle that is the body. However, there is a purpose to this existence, and the soul requires to have this phase of its existence. But it really, if you like, flies and flourishes once it is free from that fetter of the body, and that is real life.
The spiritual body grows with us as we grow in this world. In fact, we have one aspect of this rooted in the middle world, and that is why we can communicate with that world in our dreams. So in this world, we live in two bodies, but since one is like an image of the other and completely matched on it, we realize that. Now, these two bodies belong to two dimensions of the same existence. On the moment of death, the soul discards its physical body and leaves this world with its spiritual body. So when we talk of death, we actually talk of ourselves in a new body, a body which is much more complicated and much more magnificent than our physical body.
The awareness, the power of the soul that is available to it, even in Barzakh, is exponentially different to that which was available to it in life. Even the kafir and the agnostic and the atheist, their ma'rifah and knowledge of reality is much greater than any scholar who's alive now, because the veils have been lifted and they see.
So every one of us leave this world in a spiritual body, a body which is lighter, fresher, and more agile than the body in which we are living now. A body with a special DNA partially created by us in this world. But what type of experience is death? Isn't going to be the same for all? Join me in the next episode of Discovering Islam to talk about this in more details. Until then, peace be with you.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.